Last summer, as the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico was finally brought under control, our movie critic Bob Mondello did a comparison for us on Hollywood disaster movies and how they differ from real-world disasters. Well, in the last few weeks, as tragic events have played out in Japan, Bob realized he had left something out of that story, the menace that can't be seen.
Of course, Hollywood's gotten good at conjuring up visual catastrophes. Filmmakers no longer have to guess about what one looks like. Used to be, when an earthquake or tsunami struck, the chances that a camera crew would be on hand and pointed in the right direction were minuscule. Today, amateur videographers whip out cell phone cameras almost before they realize they should be running for cover. So when Clint Eastwood wanted to create a tsunami for the opening of his film Hereafter, he was able to make it verifiably, intensely, realistic. But what about that post-tsunami threat in Japan? Nuclear radiation. Hollywood has spent more than a half century trying to figure out how to put that on screen. A nuclear blast, it can show. Shows all the time, in fact. But radiation is invisible. Tricky for a medium known as motion pictures. Not impossible, mind you. Steven Spielberg famously made Jaws suspenseful, largely by keeping his shark out of sight. He knew that what you couldn't see would scare you silly. So for much of the film, all he showed of his great white was a fin. The problem with nuclear radiation is there's no fin. Invisible means invisible, so filmmakers have had to look for ways to physicalize the idea of contamination. Were scientists saying radiation could cause mutations in the 1950s? Cue Godzilla. Also ants the size of buildings, humanoids with superpowers. But that was transparently silly. At once an obvious exaggeration and not nearly as scary as the real thing. So Hollywood needed other strategies. Here's one it came up with. A Geiger counter. A Geiger counter can at least make radiation sound alarming, and in a pinch, a director can extend alarming with an actual alarm. Or two.
Ted, stabilize the reactor.
Right.
Or six, as the movie China Syndrome did.
Radiation containment.
Must be that safety valve just opened after the trip.
Somebody turn off the damned alarm.
Jack, we still have high radiation on level 8.
Perfectly normal.
None of this, let's note, is terribly cinematic. During that racket, the folks on screen are stuck in a control room, looking urgently at dials and gauges. A few years later, to be both more visual and more visceral, the movie Silkwood would show audiences the effects of radiation. Burned skin, nausea, hair loss, not to mention the brutal effort to cleanse a plutonium plant worker after she'd been exposed.
Oh, God! No!
But this approach risks turning radiation exposure into disease of the weak material. So directors came up with horror flicks with irradiated zombies, more serious pictures with gray landscapes that look not at all like the lush greenery that's now around Chernobyl. Cautionary? Sure. But as news reports on Japan's crippled reactors remind us, not quite real. For real, nobody's ever gotten it righter than director Stanley Kramer did way back in 1959. He was adapting Neville Shute's novel On the Beach, about a clutch of survivors in Australia about a year after World War III. Nuclear blasts and radiation had wiped out all animal life in the Northern Hemisphere, but Kramer didn't show any carnage. He just had submarine commander Gregory Peck let us know that wind currents were now wafting south.
When we put our nose up north of Iwo Jima, the air was filled with radioactive dust. So, we ducked. Later on, took a look at Manila through the periscope. Still too hot to surface, so we came on down the coast of Australia and ended up here. Wasn't much of any place else to go.
The film never tried to show us what was doing all this. Not with charts or maps or Geiger counters. It didn't show bodies or burns. The characters we met were pictures of health. They weren't being affected yet. They just knew they would be. And soon. And horribly. So one by one, these last survivors took their own lives. On screen, in the end, radiation just wasn't. and neither were we. I'm Bob Mundello.
In the first days after the catastrophe in Japan, Wikipedia trend spotters noticed a startling spike in people searching for information online about Godzilla. The giant reptile has been a symbol of fear of radiation since 1954 when the movie came out, and Americans are using popular culture now to think about Japan's crisis. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports.
Let's get something clear, says Grady Hendricks. He helps run the New York Asian Film Festival.
The Godzilla movies don't have anything to do with what's going on now.
The idea, says Hendricks, you can infer something about Japan's catastrophe from a movie made over 50 years ago is a little nuts. Still, he says,
movies are where we rehearse our fears.
Grady says the Godzilla films are about radiation, but from 1945, when the U.S. bombed Japan twice.
And specifically, the Godzilla series has to do with what happened in 1954 when the United States detonated a thermonuclear device on the Bikini Atoll and irradiated a Japanese fishing vessel,
killing one crewman and scorching and sickening the rest. Footage of the test survives.
The width of the fireball at this time, about 3 seconds after detonation, was 4 miles.
The U.S. government tried to cover up the Lucky Dragon 5 tragedy. It was the main inspiration for the wave of Japanese mutant monster movies that followed. For all of the radiation the U.S. inflicted on Japan in the 20th century, it's hardly as if Japan has a corner on irradiated monster flicks.
Species appears to be Camponotus ficinus.
An American movie called Them came out the same year as Godzilla. It's about 8-foot-long giant ants.
A fantastic mutation, probably caused by lingering radiation from the first atomic bomb.
Radiation needed a face in the 1950s, and the giant ants in Them and the monster in Godzilla provided that kind of horrible external representation of what these invisible forces could be.
Bill Tsutsui is a professor. He's written a book about Godzilla, and he says people didn't understand radiation in the 1950s. They feared it. So the U.S. government enlisted Disney to assuage those fears.
And here to tell you the story of our friend the Atom is the author of our book, Dr. Heinz Haber.
Still, suspicions about radiation seeped into the next decade. They helped launch an entire new genre of horror.
The brain of a ghoul has been activated by the radiation.
The zombies in the 1968 movie Night of the Living Dead were a product of radiation, says Lisa Lynch. She's a professor who studies nuclear culture. She says until the end of the Cold War, our fears about mutation were fears about radiation. Then,
fears of global pandemic started to overshadow fears of radiation. And so all of a sudden you have all these mutation movies, but the mutations are not radiation produced. They're usually mutated viruses.
Like in 28 Days Later or Zombieland. Lynch says nuclear fears went in another direction, first about power plant accidents, like in Silkwood or the China Syndrome. Today, she says, the popular imagination is more concerned with acts of deliberate terrorism.
Hijacking nuclear power plants, stealing equipment from nuclear power plants, stealing fissionable materials, dirty bombs, etc.
That was the plot of the TV show Castle just a few weeks ago.
I've been exposed to high levels of radiation. We need emergency services right away.
But there's also something about this cultural moment that seems to resonate with a more heroic side of radiation, one imbued with mid-century optimism. Broadway's most discussed musical, after all, begins with a radioactive spider bite.
And every heart that bleeds will color your world red.
Just like Spider-Man, one of the summer's most anticipated action movies is based on a Marvel Comics superhero whose powers come from radiation, Captain America.
What do you think?
I think it works.
Hollywood's even finding currency in a movie from Japan. Akira is an anime classic set in a nightmarish post-apocalyptic Tokyo after a nuclear explosion.
Maybe we weren't meant to meddle with that ultimate power.
You mean the power of a god.
Warner Brothers remaking it as a live-action film set in New York. Some of the characters are children, given strange powers by radiation. Unlike Spider-Man or Captain America, they're victims. Grady Hendricks.
When you make a movie, you're able to say, hey, this is something I'm scared of. Let me see what it's like when I visualize it. Does it make me less scared, more scared? Is it reassuring?
Whatever it is, Hendricks says, he hopes Wikipedia searches for Godzilla don't distract us from the real human suffering in Japan. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Time now to give our movie critic Bob Mondello another opportunity to help build up your video queue. This month, PBS airs a new incarnation of the British series Upstairs Downstairs. So as Bob suggests, this is a perfect moment to check out the original series.
Edwardian London, 165 Eaton Place, the Bellamy family upstairs, their servants downstairs, and on the first episode, a new parlor maid, Sarah, being introduced to Rose, the head parlor maid, played by Jean Marsh.
Rose, you are to instruct Sarah in her duties.
Yes, Mr. Hudson.
With a good heart and a glad will, if you please, Rose.
Naturally, Mr. Hudson.
Upstairs Downstairs now seems the very model of a sophisticated British series, but it had a rocky start, hit by a technician strike that made them shoot the first six episodes in black and white, then sitting on the shelf for almost a year. Still, the audience embraced it quickly, and the pilot was reshot later in color with two endings in case stations decided not to use the black and white episodes. This new 40th anniversary 20-disc set includes the alternate ending, as well as a five-part documentary, vintage talk show interviews with the stars, and more than a full day's worth of commentaries, most of which include Jean Marsh, the only cast member who will return in the new series. In the final show, she had paused with her hand on the empty house's banister, replaying moments from the previous 67 episodes in her head.
Who are you seeing on your afternoons off? I won't tell, but I know there's somebody.
I'd rather not say, Rose.
It's best to be truthful.
At the outset of the new series, Rose's hand, now covered with age spots, will touch that same banister, now covered with dust. But the dust and the age spots will disappear, as she reminisces this time, nostalgia as a fountain of youth. You may want to refresh your memory, too. I'm Bob Mondello.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block. For a while now, TV fans have been using Twitter to watch shows together. As the shows air, they make comments and jokes. Sometimes live programs, cable news, or talk shows show the tweets on screen. Well, now the stars of taped primetime reality shows are getting in on the conversation, and commentator Andrew Wallenstein loves it.
My new favorite show on Friday night is the ABC reality series Shark Tank.
In the tank, the sharks are ready to invest using their own money.
The show features entrepreneurs pitching a new product idea to a group of investors.
Hello, sharks. My name is Maddie Salen, and my product is called Wake and Bacon.
The newest shark on the show is mogul Mark Cuban.
Mark, are you really interested in this?
I like the idea.
You really think cooking bacon bedside is a good idea?
It's today? A gag gift.
But actually, Cuban didn't like the idea. I know, because I was following him on Twitter. Just as he was saying on TV how much he liked the pitch, he tweeted that he hated it. Getting that kind of inside dope is why more and more these days I find myself watching TV with Twitter on a laptop. Stars like Cuban can watch along with me and send dozens of messages per episode. Often enough, it's jokes or behind-the-scenes insights you just don't get watching the show alone. And the beauty of Twitter is that it's not one-way communication. Take Survivor, where host Jeff Probst questions competitors during the tribal council.
Parvati, is that just a known fact that everyone believes, which is Ozzy has the idol?
Yeah.
Ozzy, does that put a target on your back?
I mean, of course.
On Twitter, Probst is often the one answering questions. It makes you feel like Probst is sitting next to you on the couch while you're watching. But here's another TV star who's always pushing boundaries. Travel Channel's Anthony Bourdain.
I've had less than happy experiences with lizards in general, and iguana in particular. In fact, the last time I had it, I wanted to gargle with bleach and throw myself off a mountain.
He travels all over the world eating the craziest cuisine.
When served, it's usually with the fresh, crunchy cabbage slaw so popular around here. And it hits like a f***ing brick, let me tell you.
But while he gets bleeped on TV, you get the full flavor of Bourdain on Twitter. Which is great if you like your TV chefs a little saltier. Though Bourdain and the others may be live tweeting because they enjoy it, this is about marketing, too. More and more, people aren't watching TV shows when they're first on. They could watch on Hulu, iTunes, or their own DVRs. But the networks want to pull people back to the original air date, because that's where they charge most for commercials. Now, how's that for irony? With a little help from Twitter, good old-fashioned TV can hold its own.
Andrew Wallenstein is television editor at Variety.